listening to The Ouachita Chronicles.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Ashley.
How are you feeling?
Pretty crummy, actually, but I'm here.
I don't know if listeners, if you can notice, but Jerry's muffled. She's wearing the mask. Jerry has been ill, and so Jerry unfortunately missed out on recording today's episode with me. It was a solo venture by me. I had a little bit of assistance from producer Trey. He kind of stood in as my co-host.
I have no doubt that he did a stellar job and y'all killed it. And I missed out. And I was really sad about that while I was locked up in my home. I don't know, public safety, menace to society. But now I'm I'm back out. So beware.
That is now your new moniker, menace to society. She is a menace. Okay. Well, I'm going to leave it at that. Anyways, we did have a good episode. Our guest was a talker. Our guest was definitely a talker. If you're familiar with Mena at all, if you live here or if you come and you visit, you know that some of the things that we absolutely love about Mena are the fact that it's quiet, it's safe. There's not a lot of activity going on, especially in the evenings. Now, that's not great for our younger crowd that would like to get out and do things, but for the most part, there's been very few things to choose from as far as evening activities in this area. But as I said, that's one of the reasons we love it. That's one of the reasons that Mena is a very big tourist destination, because it is safe and quiet.
Yeah, I think this is one of those towns where they say they roll up the streets after six.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but not so much anymore, and that's why I was really bummed to miss out on visiting with our guest, and why I'm really, really looking forward to hearing it.
Right. So Mena has started to undergo a transformation, especially in the downtown area over the past few years, where new things have been added. New businesses have opened up that are giving people the opportunity to get out and enjoy things after five, after the streets have rolled up. But today's guest is one of those people. We had Derek Campbell on the show, and Derek is the owner of The Ouachitas, which is located on Mena Street. And it's many things that started out, as you'll hear in the episode, as just a coffee shop, basically. And it has evolved into what it is today, which is really a very awesome kind of night spot for everybody in town.
It's a haberdashery of hangouts.
That's pretty cool. And you can go there any time of day. It's just not just an evening thing, but we now have that option to go and hang out in a cool place in the evening and do some cool things, which you will hear about in the episode. Let's meet our guest, Derek Campbell. Welcome to this episode of The Ouachita Chronicles. I am your host, Ashley Smith. Normally, I would have my co-host, Jerry, with me, but Jerry is unfortunately otherwise occupied at the moment. But I've got a surprise co-host. Producer Trey is filling in for Jerry today. So say hi, Producer Trey.
Hello, it's good to be on this side of the microphone.
I bet it is, because you're normally stuck behind the desk the entire time. Today's guest is a local business owner, and he has really brought in something very, very different to the area, something that we haven't experienced before. So we're going to say hello to Derek Campbell. Derek?
Well, hello, everyone.
You grew up in Mena. Correct?
That's right, yes.
And did you grow up out at Campbell's Farm, out of the dairy?
Yeah, so actually, I've grown up most of my life on Highway 88 East. So until I was about a senior in high school, lived out at the country club. Then when I was about a junior, we started showing cattle and doing things like that. And so we moved out to the farm out at Campbell's Dairy, and that way I could be closer to the livestock to take care of them and do all that good stuff.
Okay, so, and you are, I mean, there's a lot of Campbells in this area. If you're familiar with Mena at all, you've got Street and Performance.
That's right.
Yeah. Street and Performance, you've got Campbell's Dairy. Your cousin, Bernice Campbell, who we will actually have on in a later podcast,
awesome,
is the organizer and creator of Fayetteville Roots Festival.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was a part of a band here in high school, and she's a part of a band up there in Fayetteville and has done a ton of traveling. But anyway, so Derek's got some cool family members, and Derek himself is pretty cool. I'm going to give him some props. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah, pretty cool. So growing up out at Campbell's Dairy on the farm, I mean, it's like you had a really different upbringing than what you're currently doing in life.
Yeah, well, I'm very thankful for the upbringing I had. As a kid, my folks always took me out, and we were either camping or riding four-wheelers or doing something like that. And in later years, we got more into the kind of ranching scene and riding horses and showing cattle, growing cattle, doing that kind of thing. So just kind of learning the worth of a hard day at work, really. So grew up just having a great appreciation for that. But yeah, definitely had a great upbringing and different kind of childhood.
but a very rural one.
Yeah, for sure.
Very rural. So while you were in high school, did you start making plans early for what you're currently doing? Was this something that, you know, you had this idea when you were young or something that came to you later in life? Because I'm interested to hear how you got out to, what, Seattle, Portland?
Seattle.
I'm interested to know the trajectory, that story. So basically, what took you from high school? What did you do right after high school? And then how did you get to Seattle?
So, you know, going through typical high school years, played sports and that kind of thing. And then when I was about 18, though, decided I wanted to surrender to the ministry, actually, and wanted to really focus on missional kind of work. Didn't know what that was going to look like, just knew that's what I was passionate about. I wanted to kind of get outside the walls of the church, get outside of just the city limits of my hometown, and go and experience new things, new people, and then also see how I could help improve those people's lives and their communities. And so, actually, after my first year of high school, spent a year going to what was then the community college here in Mena, Rich Mountain, till I really decided where I wanted to go and how I wanted to take that path. And then I transferred out to Wichita Baptist University in Arkadelphia. And from there, I just started going through school, still trying to figure out what's this going to look like, what's ministry look like for me. As I previously mentioned, growing up, spent a lot of time in the outdoors, camping, hiking, doing all that. And so that's something I was very passionate about, still am, and wanted to incorporate that into my life. So later years in college, kind of started a degree plan of a double major of recreation and also ministry. And then a cool thing happened my senior year. Wichita Baptist finalized a degree called Sports and Recreational Ministry and just came up to me and said, hey, you want to be the first to graduate with this degree plan? You've basically taken all the classes. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. So that's how I walked away from college, was with a sports and recreational ministry degree.
Okay, I just got to stop and say, that's weird. Yeah. Like, that's very cool, but that's not something you would hear every day.
Yeah.
So you were literally the first one to get this degree.
Yeah,
from
first
Washington
one to
Baptist.
Get that degree. Basically, it entails taking all your basic entry-level ministry classes, whether it be children's worship or, you know, anything like that, preaching to taking coaching classes and canoeing and backpacking, and then a few classes on how to like incorporate ministry in the outdoors together through that kind of avenue. So it was pretty cool.
Is this not cool? That is cool.
That is fascinating. I didn't even know that that was a career path that you could take, a ministry sports director of some sort. Like,
yeah, actually one of the semesters in my junior year, I went out to California. It was kind of more or less a study abroad program where I spent about half the semester there in California doing those kind of things, ministry related, outdoor backpacking, rock climbing in the Ansel Adams and Yosemite Wilderness. And I went out there thinking, man, this is a cool place. It'd be awesome to have a job there one day. And then you also spend about 6 weeks in Ecuador as a part of it too, doing mountaineering. And then all the time while we're there, a whole part of this, the organization I was with was called Summit Adventures, is it's service and adventure. So
right.
While we're there, you know, going to orphanages, painting, teaching English, doing cool things like that. And so that was also part of that whole experience while I was there. One of my professors recommended I go do that because that's exactly along the lines of what I had described. Hey, this is what I want to do professionally in a sense. And so I did that. And then actually my senior year, as I was graduating, Summit Adventure called me up and offered me a job. And so that's how I first landed in California after college.
Nice.
Yeah. And so I went out there and worked for them for a little bit over a year, just doing that exact thing. My focus was with college students coming into that same program that I was in, basically kind of like their RA, taking care of them, but then also guiding and leading them on backpacking trips, rock climbing trips, all that good stuff, helping them with their classes and stuff that they took there. So that was really cool. But I could hear my father in the background of my head saying, hey, what you gonna do? Where are you gonna be? Where are you going to plant your roots at? That's
right.
Very much who he is, hardworking man, just kind of planting roots and growing and pushing through everything. Looking back, maybe I should have done that for another year or so. But after about a year, I moved back to Mena, and I was in Mena for about 6 months and then moved to Fort Smith for a little bit. And at that point, that's where I met Jennifer, who started the coffee adventure with me. And then February of 2015, we moved to Seattle. And the whole idea of coffee came about, again, still working in the ministry while I was there in Fort Smith, still very concerned and wanting to do missional work, and had an interest in coffee, but it wasn't until that year that I discovered coffee I liked. I tried for a long time to like coffee, never could find anything that was good, you know, just drinking my father's Folgers or something like that, and couldn't understand it, but I really loved the aesthetic of it, my grandparents sitting around drinking it, what it kind of represented. And then one day, sitting in a coffee shop, I ordered a pour over and I got this really nice black coffee that had all these different tasting notes that I was not familiar with, and it really excited me. So I started a deep dive into researching what makes coffee good, or at least to my opinion, what makes it good, and started seeing there's something really cool here, and developed a vision of, well, here's what I'd like to do with my life. I think it'd be cool to have my own coffee shop, because I've always loved spending time in coffee shops. Have my own coffee roaster, so that one day maybe I could grow to the point where I could import my own coffee, travel to all these different countries, all these different communities around the world, import coffee, and then return to those communities on a business trip. But yes, with a mission in mind, with a purpose. Take my staff, take my family, my community on these trips and go back and see how I can pour back into these communities that I'm importing coffee from, and just having this very easy kind of way of doing life and ministry. Mm-hmm. And that really excited me. But I knew that I wasn't going to learn what I wanted to learn about coffee in Arkansas.
At
least to the rate that I wanted to and at the rate I wanted to. Then I moved out to Seattle because, hey, this is a coffee mecca. This is where it's all happening.
That's the homeland.
Yeah, that's where you go. Where it's growing, where cool things are happening. So I went out there and just sought out a job in some respectable places and just started my learning process.
That's really, really amazing. So, I mean, obviously you'd already were pretty well traveled, but I imagine that there's probably still a culture shock type of difference moving to a city like Seattle.
Oh, most definitely.
You know, Pacific Northwest, and they've got the deciduous rainforest there. I can imagine, you know, so you went out there with the girl that you were with at the time.
Yeah.
And got a job and just started learning. You know, how long were you there and what was the point where you were like, okay, I'm ready to do this on my own?
We went out there at first and we moved out there also and kind of helped out a church plant that we were somewhat connected to mm-hmm. while being here in Arkansas. So we had that small community.
A little bit of support.
Yeah, once we got out there. And so we went out and visited them first and kind of looked around at the area and some different shops and even went into a couple interviews before we ever moved out there. Didn't want to move out there without at least some idea of a job potential. And so when we got there, we both had job offers waiting for us. She took one. I sought out some other ones, started in this one little shop, kind of mom and pop style thing. After about a month or so being there, realized this wasn't where I was going to need to be, at least to learn what I was hoping to learn. And thankfully got hooked up with some amazing folks. A shop called Urban Coffee Lounge. They had two locations less than 10 miles apart out there, and they were a wholesale account of Stuptown Coffee Roasters.
Okay.
Which at that point, they were doing some really cool things, still just ahead of the game, and especially coffee industry. And so I was able to go into there, and I told that owner when I was interviewing, I was like, hey, this is my goal. This is what I want to do with my life. This is why I'm here in Seattle. I'm from Arkansas. This is the goal for me to learn as much as I can. I want to become the best employee I can before you, and you know, if I can be one of your trainers here. They're like, great, yeah, we'll take you up on that. And they really did. They respected that. And as I learned and put time into it, they allowed me to go in. Like, I lived right outside of Seattle, worked right outside. I would go into Seattle to the roaster once or twice a week, just learning from their brewers and their roasters there on how to make coffee, the best way to do it, customer service, all that kind of stuff. Anything that you experience at the Washtaws now is a big result of the people that poured into me from Stumptown Coffee Roasters there in Seattle.
You got to walk me through coffee. And I know that this could take a while, but I mean, there's so much more to the entire process than so many people know. Like you just, like you said, you've been exposed to Folgers. Right?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And the first time you have a really, really good cup of coffee, it is kind of life changing. You know, yeah. I didn't start drinking coffee till I was probably 21, 22, mm-hmm. you know, and I was very fortunate that I'd gone into some good coffee shops in other areas across the state and out of state, et cetera. You know, as far as basically from the plant to the cup.
Yeah. So, well, that first cup that I had, you know, you go into your grocery stores and you look on the shelves and you see these different roasts, these different blends. And then for some reason you see a coffee bag that says Ethiopia on it or Colombia. And you're like, what is this? When I personally was looking at that, I don't know, 8 years ago, I guess, I didn't understand that coffee was from Ethiopia and Colombia. I mean, I was quite ignorant, I guess. But that first cup of coffee I had that was that pour over in this little specialty coffee shop, it was what would be called a natural processed Ethiopian coffee. And these coffees are known for being fruity, for being bright, to having these very just unique tasting notes to them. And so when I was drinking that, even though it was the first excellent cup of coffee I had and didn't really have a palate for it, I could tell, wow, there's something very different about this.
It's complex.
And so that's when I started researching. I was like, wow, there's so much I do not know about coffee. And if I want to do this at the level I want to, as we've already said, I need to go somewhere I can learn all that. And so going from the plant to the cup of coffee you have in your hand right now, it's quite a process. And so you have all these growing regions that are very close to the equator because that's where coffee grows best. It's a crop. Just like any other crop, it's going to have areas where it grows great and then other areas where it doesn't yield the harvest that it would need to yield. So coffee grown in the U.S. or anywhere around here isn't going to be that great due to our climate, due to our soil type, due to our elevation. All those things really matter when it gets into growing coffee.
Okay.
So that's why you see Africa and you see Colombia, Indonesia, all these places, they're going to be near that equator, having high elevation most of the time. And that temperate climate is what we're looking for. And that's going to grow your good coffee crops. And these coffee plants, they can be, this is going to be like a wine terminology, but like different varietals, different type of plants, again, to grow best where they're located.
Right.
And also even to the type of people that's harvesting it, because the great majority of it is harvested by hand. So are you in a country where it's mainly short people and they're trying to reach up and grab from a tall plant? It wouldn't work. So they grow plants that are actually shorter in height. And or you can go to these places where they have tools and ladders and can go up, you know, a 6 or 8 foot plant.
I didn't know they got that tall.
Yeah. It's in each one of these plants is going to yield a different type of coffee bean. That different type of coffee bean is going to have the potential to have a different kind of complex flavor profile. And so these are all the things that are considered when you're going into selecting your coffee. So there it is. It's grown in all these places, and they'll go out, like I said, and they'll harvest these crops mostly by hand, put them into baskets, and then truck them back, you know, a quarter to 2 miles back to their farm, right? Mm-hmm. And then the coffee will undergo sorting. And so what it looks like is your bean is going to be in what looks like a cherry, just little red cherry sized type fruit, and your coffee bean is inside of that. So they have to go out and they have to harvest the ripe ones, right? When they get it back to the farm, they do some sorting if some other ones fell in the basket to make sure they get rid of the ones that aren't quite ripe, et cetera, et cetera. Then the coffee goes through a processing method. And that processing method, basically all it is taking the bean that's in that cherry and removing it from that cherry, right?
Right.
I mean, there's three main ways to do that. I'll tell you very quickly. There's a wash process, a natural process, and a honey process. There's other methods, but mm-hmm. these are the ones that are primarily used and the ones that you'll see in my shop most often. Washed uses lots of water. It's very quick. Through some means, they will pulp the cherry, squeeze the bean out, either through a machine or by hand, and then they'll use water to wash all the mucus and anything, residual things that may be on that bean off. And it's believed that this could be like the best way to process coffee because it gets it super clean very quickly and there's no residual flavors left on it by anything. It's just what the bean
right.
has to
water.
Offer.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But in a lot of countries, we know that water isn't something that's readily
scarce
available.
Resource, yes.
So this is why there's different processing methods in different areas. And so then you also have a natural processed coffee, which they'll take all those cherries that they sorted, they'll lay them out on drying screens. The sun will dry that cherry out. So you can imagine those juices at that point are going into that bean to some extent.
Uh-huh.
And then with less water, often they'll wash those dry cherries off, and then you got your coffee beans.
Okay.
But you have a very different one. You can take two beans and process them those two different ways and get two very different tasting coffees just due to what they went through. And then your natural processed coffees, like I said earlier, they'll have like a very fruity, bright citrus taste to them due to that cherry having dried on them and those juices being somewhat absorbed. The third is what's called a honey process. And honey has nothing to do with the processing method. It's more so a tasting note that will be left behind
okay.
on the beans. And again, the bean will be pulped out of the cherry, but to some extent, that mucus membrane that's left on it, just like if you got a seed out of a cherry, right, is kind of left on that coffee bean. It's not washed off heavily with water. They might do a little bit, and they'll do it to certain different degrees with the honey processed. But this is going to leave tasting notes close to, like I said, honey, even, you know, kind of sugary type.
So it's leaving
sweetness.
A sweetness behind.
Yeah, it's because a different kind of sweetness where you got fruit kind of sweetness on the natural end. And then on your honey process, you'll have honey taste. Tasting notes, sugar cane tasting notes, sometimes even
a
like
thicker,
that sweetness
like
you get
a,
in bourbon.
Okay, so we're to the point where they've gotten the coffee bean, the actual coffee
yeah.
bean out of the cherry type thing.
Yeah, so then at that point, that's where hopefully what I'll be getting to do one day, but an importer will come in and try out all these different types of coffees, these different sections of the crops, and they'll separate it into lots and be like, well, hey, this part of your crop grew way better or yielded a much better coffee. So we're going to bring that in, but we'll also bring that in. You know, they'll kind of sort through it. They'll roast it up. They'll taste it. And then they bring it in. And I currently use some guys out of Kansas City, Anthem Importers. So they're the ones that's doing this on my behalf at this time. And they'll bring it in and then they'll ship out samples to your roasters and such. And then a roaster like myself will take that sample, roast it up, taste it, decide if that's something I want to bring in and add to my menu or that's not really my style or what I think my customers are going to like. So at this time, you know, I've gone through hundreds of different samples, but I've only brought in probably somewhere between 20 and 30 different types of coffees.
Okay, well, that's a pretty small percentage for what you've tried.
Right.
Is coffee given grades?
It is. So the first level is going to be either commodity coffee or specialty coffee. A misconception is specialty coffee is like a mocha or a caramel macchiato. That's not it at all. Specialty coffee is the grade at which that coffee bean is. Commodity coffee is going to be the culls or the ones that got sorted off and didn't quite make that specialty coffee standard or what have you. And so a lot of what you see like in grocery stores, that's going to be it primarily is your commodity grade coffee.
Okay.
So that's where your first big price breaking point is.
Okay. Who decides those grades? Is it the importers who are coming in?
Yes. Yeah.
So you said, because what got me thinking about this was you said that they were, you know, taking different sections of the crop as they're trying everything and tasting. And in my head, I was wondering, okay, are they assigning grades while they're doing that? So it's not the actual like grower, the producer that's assigning it. It's the importers, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. More or less. There's going to be different checks and balances, but yeah, that's going to be it.
All right. So we got commodity and then we've got specialty.
Specialty grade, which is the only thing that I bring in at Washtenaw. And what a lot of your kind of third wave, so to speak, coffee shops are going to be using is your specialty grade coffee. Hopefully any coffee shop that's brewing espresso, making lattes, that's what they're going to be using.
Okay, so you're bringing in beans, you've said 20 to 30 samples. I mean, you've tried hundreds of samples, but you've really only brought in about 20 to 30.
Yeah, I'll roast up the samples. I'll do what's called a cupping, and that's where I'll take those samples. I mean, it's basically a very simple science experiment, and you dose the same amount of coffee, add the same amount of water at the same temperature, and you let it steep for the same amount of time, and you pull the coffee off. And you just go down through the line and do a blind tasting so that you don't have any preconceived notions of like what you prefer. And then you're just like assessing that coffee, how it is, and be like, this is what I'm gonna bring in as a single origin, or this would be great to blend with this coffee, so on and so forth. I mean, I do that more or less on a weekly basis anyway. It's just to kind of grade my coffee, to grade the roast that I'm doing, see how I can improve on it, see some inadequacies in it, and try to correct that either in the roast or some other way. But yeah, then once I select some coffees I'm really thrilled about, I tell my importer, I'm like, hey, I like this, ship me this, and they'll send in the 150, 160 pound bags of green coffee, and then I store it in there and start roasting and creating profiles.
Mm-hmm.
That's the next step. Once the coffee gets imported here, then the coffee is shipped to me. I get it in, and say it's a new coffee. Remember, all these coffees are from different origins. They're grown at different elevations, slightly different climates, different soils, and then a huge thing is how they're processed. And so all those factors go into how that coffee bean receives heat and reacts to heat while it's being roasted. So say I have a Colombian coffee and an Ethiopian coffee, and the Colombian's washed and the Ethiopian's a natural process. I have to roast those two beans separately because they're gonna be roasted a different profile, again, because they react to heat differently.
Right.
So I bring them in, start the roasting process, and kind of see how they react to the heat. I have certain goals that I have for the coffee. I'll charge it at a certain temperature, drop it into the roaster, kind of see where it bottoms out and starts rising back in heat. And at certain points, certain minutes along in the roast, I want it to be at a certain temperature, and I want it to end at a certain temperature at a certain time. And so I have these basic goals, and then I just kind of react to the coffee as it's going through that roast process to build that profile.
Tweak it the way you
want it. I want it. And then I'll do several batches of coffee, and then the next day I'll cup it. I'll see which one of those batches I thought was best. I'll go back in my computer, look at that profile, be like, this one's spot on. I'll save it and I'll use it next week. And it's just a continual thing. I might change one little thing each time I roast to see if it does better or worse. Then I'll try it. And then that's how we are constantly, basically every week, improving on our coffee, is because I'm always tasting it, always trying to learn something new on how I can improve that cup of coffee.
So when you're getting those 150, 160 pound bags of beans, and you said you had to roast those separately from each other because they're going to have different flavor profiles depending. When you hit on one that you love and you're like, this is a star, this is great, this needs to be served at the Washtenaws all the time, can you count on getting that exact same bean again?
I would say a good majority of the time I can. My contact at Anthem, you know, we go back and forth and I say, hey, here's my staples. And he knows what I like. And so I would say most of the time I'm able to get the staples that I need or something close enough to it. So you'll have, for example, right now I'm doing a natural Ethiopian, and it comes from a farm called Roosevelt Aricha. And it's going to be different than a natural Ethiopian that came from a farm that has the name of Hambala. And so they're both natural Ethiopians. They're grown in the same part of the world, right? But they're coming from different farms. They're going to have slight differences in their taste, but we're going to be able to overachieve our goal in getting that staple coffee. And so sometimes that specific farm will change. But for example, Shady Mountain is our blend that we use for our espresso, and it's just something we've had from the beginning. It's a natural Ethiopian coffee blended with a washed Colombian coffee. It will always be a natural Ethiopian. It'll always be a washed Colombian, but the farm that it came from may be different depending on the time of year. Just growing seasons, availability.
Yeah, just crops turn out differently. Right. It doesn't matter if they're from the same farm or not.
Yeah, and so it's just my job to get those roasts down to where it is consistent. And that's usually not a problem. We do get micro lots in sometimes, like, hey, this is a very special coffee. There was only one bag of it. We're going to have it for about 3 months, and that's it.
And that's it.
And then that's how we advertise it. That's how we sell it. And then 3 months later, we bring in another very special micro lot that was available.
Yeah, it's like a pop-up. It's like a pop-up coffee.
Yeah, and it's super cool because Anthem, they're a small kind of family-based importing group. So they don't just import a ton of coffee from all over the place and just all this different stuff. They have a limited selection, but what their selection is the best that there is out there, at least in my opinion.
Nice. So you have sought out to work with the best so you can be the best. I was with the chamber for many years, and when Closet 821 was still open, I can remember coming in there to visit with Kayla and you and Jennifer sitting at a table when this was just being planned. And you remember we sat down and we visited because we were talking about some chamber stuff and just business stuff in general. And this was when the idea was in conception. You guys were about to start the build out in the Closet 821 boutique. You know, you came back from Seattle, back to MENA, with this plan, correct?
Right.
And how long did it take you after getting back to MENA to get this set in motion?
We came back not just with the goal initially to be like, all right, we're going to jump into this. We're going to do this now. We're back. We're kind of getting into what our day jobs are at this point. Would still love to do this. Don't know when that's going to happen. I would say about a year of being back in MENA, and then one thing leading to another, whether it all started by somebody saying, hey, you've been to Seattle, you want to do coffee, could you just like roast and provide coffee for our church? And we're like, well, maybe. And so started researching roasters and coffee equipment, and that just continued to snowball out of control until, all right, we're going to open a full-blown coffee roaster and coffee bar here in MENA. And so from landing here to kind of that snowball effect to opening up our doors, I think it was around October 2018, was about a year in the making.
Listeners, if you're not familiar with the area, they started right here in MENA on MENA Street. And what I like to say about MENA Street is in MENA, we're so proud of ourselves. We don't have a main street. We have MENA Street. We named our main street after ourselves. But they're in a very, very cool location. But what was originally a lifestyle boutique. And so they started there and kind of built out a little portion of it to be able to have a little coffee bar in this lifestyle boutique. And then that just grew. I mean, it just blew up. I can remember it not being a very long period that you guys were in there with Kayla before Kayla was moving out and you guys were taking over.
Yeah, initially probably working with, you know, I don't know, not much space, about a 50 by 75 foot space.
It wasn't very big, I remember.
No, it was more like 25 foot wide. But yeah, it started out, you know, it was awesome kind of getting to build it out in that one little area. I knew the equipment that I wanted from the different coffee manufacturers and suppliers. And so seeking that out, creating partnerships with those and getting all that in there and kind of building that out. And for a little while, you know, it was a little bit awkward. How's this going to be? We're kind of tucked in the back corner of this lifestyle boutique.
But it seemed like that's an advantage. That would have been an advantage that a lot of new business owners, small businesses don't have, is that you're able to take over a small space in an already established business who already has foot traffic and customers, and you're just offering something extra. So I bet a lot of people would have jumped at a chance to be able to do something like that. But it did look weird. The layout didn't look weird. The clientele, it was interesting, because I can remember Lauren and Kayla saying to me after the first few weeks of you guys being open, they were like, we're having to vacuum the floor a lot more because they had so much traffic coming in and people in work boots with mud on their boots and just this whole different clientele that would not have normally come to the lifestyle boutique was coming in for your coffee.
Yeah, and that's MENA. It's been interesting because before we opened up and decided to do it, we considered some other places, maybe moving to Fort Smith or going to Hot Springs to do it. But I'm from here. I love the area. And being from the area, you know people. You have contacts. You have a reputation. And so I believe that MENA was a great place to start it because of those reasons. I've never started a business. So having people that I could go talk to and have a little help with and not have this regulated thing just breathing down my neck constantly would make it a little bit easier for me. And so, yeah. Opening up in the boutique, it was interesting, and I think it was helpful. It got us some more foot traffic for sure, like you're saying, and it did kind of feel kind of weird, and we had hopes and ambitions for what the future could be, and I think we did that for the first about 10 months, and we're like, hey, we want some more space.
Yeah.
Because at that point, we had seating for maybe 10 people, and that wasn't even comfortable, and so started that conversation, and by February 2019 was right around there is when we bought the building, and then over the next several months, year, started the renovation of the building.
And what a renovation it is. If you have not been to the Washtaws here locally, it's really unlike anything else we have in MENA. It's an aesthetic that you know, you're not going to find in this area generally. You find it in some other towns, you know, Fayetteville, Little Rock, the bigger cities, but you don't find that aesthetic in a rural town. And the fact that, you know, it was brought here, gosh, it's just absolutely gorgeous. There's no other way to describe it. It's a gorgeous place. But that build out, it did take a while, I remember, for you guys to get to the point, especially to get to the point you're at right now and what you're doing right now, which we definitely want to dive into a little bit, because, I mean, you took that whole coffee brewing thing, which is an extremely scientific method. It is.
It is.
It's brewing, and, you know, you're brewing something else now. So that's where we want to go with this now, is to talk about what you've turned this into, because, man, this is something Mina has needed for a very long time, and it's monumental. It's very historic for our area.
Yeah, so in April 2019, Arkansas passed a bill where a microbrewery could exist within a dry county. I actually had my first beer when I was 24, and that was when I was in California working for Summit Adventure. Went to this small little microbrewery down in the town of Oakhurst. It was a super cool place, and that was my first experience, was in a small, very well done microbrewery. I was like, oh, wow, this is really cool. Because up to that point, I was very conservative, so to speak, and hadn't drank alcohol, wasn't a part of my life. But at that point, I was in a community where I saw that was very healthy, and it was more than a community. It was like a craft. It was something really cool, mm-hmm. just in the same way that coffee is.
It's an art.
Yeah. And so my next passion then at that point when I was 24 was craft beer. And so I started researching it and enjoying it. But coffee is an easier venture to begin with, obviously, especially within a dry county. But I always had a microbrewery kind of in the back of my mind of that.
So wouldn't this was that be the cool? plan from the beginning?
No, it wasn't the plan. Just in the same way that as I was going through college, like, man, it'd be neat to kind of have a coffee shop one day. Then go in and experience microbrewery, be like, this is a cool environment. I like hanging out here. How cool would it be to do that one day?
Right.
Just that in the back of your mind.
And yeah.
Because coffee was that forever until, like I said, in 2015. You know, as I'm doing coffee and kind of looking at Mina and seeing what else would be a great thing to add to it. Because, I mean, to be honest, like a coffee roaster in a coffee shop, it's going to do all right. But it's not really going to get me where I want to be with my ambitions of traveling the world and going to all different places. I'd like to see my business do more. I'd like to just reach more people. I need a bigger audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Arkansas passed that bill, that idea started kind of just heating up a little bit more. Started having that conversation, had it with my family. And, you know, starting out, that's a tough conversation with, you know, people being conservative, having their beliefs. And so it was a long conversation. But from that point in April 2015, we started that journey because it still had to go through and get it passed and all the regulations put into place. And so that took a long time.
I was going to say, you had some trouble with that, and not through any fault of your own whatsoever, but just the fact that this was something that was newly passed, and then the state actually getting the applications out, mm-hmm. and all the processing and all the red tape that you had to go through, it took a lot longer than what you expected, correct?
Yes, it took close to a year from it being passed to them actually being, all right, here's an application. Because we started researching it, you know, in April, and then in October of that year is when we're like, let's do this. And so I actually hired a lawyer, started getting all the paperwork in line because we believed that surely by December we'd be able to apply. But that wasn't the case. It was later into the spring that we were able to apply.
But you were so confident that you started the remodel and the build out on the brewery portion of your restaurant before you even had the license.
Because when we bought the building, started remodeling, we opened up our kitchen, you know, and we started doing pizzas and stuff like that in December of 2019. And so we had that portion going, and then we had started along the lines of getting the brewery going. And before we ever had a permit or even had applied for it, yeah, I basically had a built out tap room, walk-in cooler, brewery ready to go.
So just the second they stamped the approval.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they finally did that, I guess we've been operating a little over 3 months now. We opened up our brewery the day before Halloween. They had their meeting. I had my brother-in-law pick up my permit from the ABC office there in Little Rock, and then I drove up the next day and got it from him. And on my way home with that permit in my hand, only having it maybe 2 hours, I picked up a F-350 one-ton dually truckload of kegs. For a one-ton, it was quite the haul for it. Mm-hmm. I think we had nearly 30 kegs in the back of that truck, and we brought it home, threw them in the cooler. And then the next day, we were open for business. And so we were ready.
That is amazing. You know, I got into craft beer right about the time that the movement really started to explode across the U.S. Arkansas was a little bit behind the curve, but not very much.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you had places like Core and Lost 40. Diamond Bear has been there for a long time. So, but having something like this in Mena, as I said, it's monumental.
Right.
I never imagined in the, you know, 25 plus years that I've lived in Mena that I would see anything like this.
Right. Right.
So Mena, as I said, is in a dry county. We do have some private clubs. So we've got a couple restaurants here that can sell alcohol, but only, you know, to a certain extent, and they've got to have food served with it. But what the Ouachita's is totally different because it is a microbrewery. So, yeah. I mean, they're producing beer, they're brewing beer in-house, but they also have beers from, you know, other breweries.
That's right.
And they've got a great menu.
So what's neat about the Ouachita's, it doesn't matter what time of day it is, there's a reason to stop in. So starting up, we open up at 7 a.m. You know, you can get your coffee, get your pastries. And just this year, we've launched our full brunch menu. And so on the daily, we're serving this amazing brunch that I'm stoked about, that I get to show up for work every day and get something different off the menu. And if I feel like it, you know what, I'm going to have a mimosa while I'm at it. Maybe a beer mimosa, who knows? So we got, you know, excellent coffee. We have a huge reputation for that. That's just been growing and blowing up. And I'm super pleased and proud of our coffee program. And I have, you know, some full-time chefs on staff that are just really making my kitchen amazing. Kind of any experience you have at Ouachita is going to be like nothing else that you had in Mena. I mean, so it's been really cool. We got the brunch. We got the coffee in the morning. Lunchtime, you can still have brunch. We do that till 1. But also we have our pizzas, our salads, our wings. Soon coming is going to be our street tacos. We're very excited about that. We have 29 beers on tap. So there's going to be something on that wall that you like, if not several. And you can come in weekly and there's going to be something new on there. That menu is constantly changing, usually on the daily. We don't just pick 29 beers and just run with them. We're constantly bringing in something new or different and replacing different beers and swapping them in and out.
Well, beers are seasonal.
So along with our beer, we also have a really nice wine menu that I'm proud of. A lot of great ones to select and choose from, whether it be a bottle of wine or a glass of wine. And then we're open late. You know, we're open till 10 p.m. every day. And now we're open 7 days a week. That started this past week.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know you guys were open on Sundays now.
We are open on Sundays now. And then we do trivia every Tuesday night.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell me about the entertainment because there is an entertainment feature. They did build a small little platform stage. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, the aesthetic at the Ouachita's is gorgeous. I mean, it's something that if I had been in your position, I probably would have gone the exact same way because, man, it's just really, really cool in there.
Thank you.
But there is a stage there. And so you guys have got some different entertainment lined up weekly, mm-hmm. but some recurring entertainment. So you said trivia night?
Yeah, every Tuesday at 7, we do trivia. And it's been a blast. It's been a good hit for us. A lot of the community really enjoys it. And then pretty much every Saturday night this month in January and then continuing on from now on, we'll have a live performance on our stage. Some local artists, a lot of Arkansas musicians coming in that, I mean, I've never even heard most of the people that are coming in. And so sometimes we'll have music on Friday nights as well. And that the entertainment's going to continue to grow. But I'm really excited about that.
Well, do you want to give any special shout outs or anything to any, you know, staff members or just anything that's kind of, is really important to mention? I mean, you have a great staff and you've got to have a good staff to get to the level that you've gotten to so quickly, for sure. Because this is a pretty involved business. I mean, not only have you got everything that you're doing here, you also are a vendor, correct?
To
coffee shops across
the
state?
Yeah, I wholesale my coffee out to different coffee shops or little boutiques, and I go and train their staff and do follow-ups with them. And yeah, I do the best I can to take care of them, supply them with coffee equipment, all that good stuff.
Okay, and also really quick, want to run down, because I love that you did this. Absolutely love that you did this. You know how proud I am of the Ouachita's. My roots, my home, and I love everything about this area. So I was really happy when I saw your bagged coffee for sale and the blends and what they were named. So can you tell me a little bit about what inspired those? And
yeah, just loving the area and then also just working to get community support. We name our blends after different areas or outdoor kind of destinations here in Mena. So as I mentioned, Shady Mountain is just a well-known area that people will go, ride four-wheelers, hang out, camp, beautiful mountain area. And that's what our main blend is named after. I think it's a super cool name. Occasionally we'll release a specialty blend called the Yakini blend. If you're not from Mena, you wouldn't know how to pronounce that when you saw it on the sign as you drove in.
Yokana.
So it's always fun when people pick that up off the retail shelf and they're, what's this Yokana blend? They're like, great, where are you from?
Yeah.
not from Mena. And, you know, we've had Big Brushy blend as well. And that's kind of how we handle our blends when they're not that specially single origin coffee.
So. Well, it fits very well with the overall name because, I mean, you started as Ouachita Coffee Roasters.
Yeah.
And as, you know, things were added to the business, you had to expand that out. And now just to cover everything, it's just the Ouachita's.
The Ouachita's, yeah.
Okay. You've also got some cool merchandise. Just a shout out for, you know, anybody who goes in there. They've got really awesome travel mugs and tumblers and hats and shirts. Just really neat stuff in there for sale. For listeners who are not, you know, here locally or regionally or even in the state where they could travel and make a trip to MENA and see you, give us your contact info as far as, you know, website or just reaching out to you directly if somebody was interested in carrying your coffee in their boutique or store or they just want to get online and order some stuff.
Yeah, thewashitas.com is our website. You can always hit me up at my email and it's just Derek, D-E-R-E-K at washitacoffee.com with any wholesale requests or questions or needs, or if you're just in Texas and you are Dallas, Fort Worth area, and you've been here and you loved our coffee and you need me to ship you some more, shoot me an email. I'll hook you up, get you some sent out. And we always love doing that. And yeah, like you're saying, I certainly do appreciate my staff. I wouldn't be who I am or what I am or what I'm doing without them. Phenomenal group of people that make the Washitas what it is. At this part, I'm a small part of what it is. Great leadership there. People coming in, just devoting their time and their gifts and abilities to what we're doing. I'm super appreciative of that as well. And love my community. Yeah, I mean, MENA has been good to me, and I'm very thankful. I built the Washitas out so that the town of MENA would have a place to gather, no matter what it is they enjoy doing, to catch up with friends, hang out, eat, enjoy, just some time together. I love MENA, and I'm glad MENA's loving back on the Washitas so much more than anybody realizes.
They do. I mean, as I mentioned, I've been a customer from the very beginning, but it is a really, really fun spot for me to go to, and I always see people I know there. If I were to go in by myself, I'm going to end up sitting down with someone or by someone that I know. I'm going to move into what we like to call our lightning round. And this is how we wrap up our podcast. And I think if you've listened, you've heard this, but just real short, quick questions and real short, quick answers. Don't really have to explain if you want to. If there's something that you like to touch on, feel free. Okay. Favorite color?
Gray.
Cat person or dog person?
Dog for sure.
If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
I'd be a jumper. If you're familiar with that, there's a movie called Jumper. Basically, if you've seen a place or see a picture of it, you just close your eyes and like that.
Teleportation?
Yeah, basically.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
A pizza delivery man. Yeah, believe it or not. I delivered my first pizza during COVID when we were doing delivery. And as I pulled up somebody's house, it dawned on me that I had fulfilled my dream.
Your childhood dream.
Of being like a little first grader, being like, I want to be a pizza delivery man. Because I love pizza. And I like making people happy. So what makes people more happy than having pizza delivered to their house?
And
I was
like, that's what I want to be. That was the first food that you offered. Okay. What artist or song do you have on repeat right now?
Jeez. I don't even know if I can answer that question. Been listening to a lot of, like, I think it's M83.
Okay, I've not heard of artist. That.
Yeah. I can't even describe it. It's just, it kind of, something that plays in the background and sticks in the back of my head and is relaxing and kind of chills the stress out.
Okay, if you could have a dinner party with three people, dead or alive, they don't have to be famous, but they can be, who would you choose?
I mean, Anna would have to be there.
Okay.
She's my girlfriend. I wouldn't be having fun if she wasn't there. And then we could relive the stories later together. So I need two more. Maybe Abraham Lincoln.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then Will Ferrell. I think that'd be a pretty neat hangout.
That is the quickest answer we've ever had on that question.
Yeah. Everybody, they get two. And then the third one, they cannot get. So Abraham Lincoln and Will Ferrell.
Yeah. I'm just like, a lot of times if I'm watching a Will Ferrell movie, I'm just like, man, he just seems like he'd be fun to hang out with. Or him or like Marky Mark. Like, they both just crack me up.
Mark Wahlberg?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. That'd be a good time. But I'm trying to, in my head, I'm trying to reconcile the dynamic between Will Ferrell and Abraham Lincoln. Because I feel like I've read enough that Abraham Lincoln had a pretty good sense of humor.
Yeah, once he got over the culture shock and we got on the same page, I think.
Yeah.
It would be pretty cool.
I bet so.
I'd love to give him like a coffee and then be like, here, try this beer.
Okay, last one. If you could go back in time and tell yourself something at any age, I mean, you know, 10 to 15 seconds to tell your younger self something, what would you say?
It'd be my younger self, probably somewhere in high school. I always had the dream of being the absolute best at something. I just want to be the best, whether it be like mountain biking, motocross. I've always been a dreamer. I've been passionate and wanted to do something different. Didn't want to have like a 9-to-5 by any means. I mean, at this point, it's an 8 to, you know, midnight, but I love it. So I would tell myself, hey, like, never stop dreaming, and you are capable of doing absolutely anything. Don't let anyone ever crush those dreams or the ideas that you have. Like, persevere through it, because the stuff that I've just been like blessed to accomplish, you know, never thought that it would happen. I did believe in myself, but even if I had that little extra, like, hey, just don't stop, do it, I feel like I could be even further from here.
That's good advice for anyone, not just Derek's younger self, but yeah, that is excellent, excellent advice. And I'm sure that your younger self would be really amazed to see where you've gotten at this point, if they had any idea, if they could look forward. All right, so if you are in MENA area, I mean, anywhere in Arkansas, it's worth a day trip to MENA, but you must stop at the Washtaws.
821 MENA Street.
I should have remembered. So the Washtaws at 821 MENA Street in MENA, Arkansas. Like Derek said, website address again?
The Washtaws.
TheWashtaws.com. And you can reach Derek at Derek@WashtawCoffee.com. WashtawCoffee.com. You can find him on Facebook and you can find them on Instagram. Derek, thank you so very much for coming in and visiting with us. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you, Ashley. I appreciate it.
It's time for that portion of the show we like to call Fast Facts with Producer Trey. So today's episode with Derek Campbell, talking about the evolution of his business, the Washtaws, going from a coffee roaster all the way to a microbrewery. It's a very, very cool episode. I had a lot of fun recording it, even though I didn't have Jerry with me. It turned out well. We were really happy with it. And I learned a lot of things about Derek that I didn't know. Not too many things came up in the episode. I mean, honestly, really nothing came up that we had questions on that we truly needed to fast fact. I came up with a few things because, I don't know, Jerry, you know me. I've got things in my head the whole time I'm talking to people. My wheels are turning. I'm thinking while I'm listening to your conversation. I mean, I just can't shut it off.
It's definitely one of your most dangerous pastimes.
Well, being an 80s, 90s baby, as I am, an 80s baby growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, the whole time I was interviewing Derek, I'm sitting here looking at him, I just kept thinking in my head that he was the modern hipster version of Juan Valdez. After the interview was done, he'd left and I was talking with producer Trey. And I said, hey, do you know who Juan Valdez is? And producer Trey's like, no, I mean, like, I'm 19 years old. Like, I don't know who that is.
I'm 35. I don't know who that is.
You don't know who Juan Valdez is. No. Okay, producer Trey, you did some digging for us. Who's Juan Valdez?
Juan Valdez is a character representing a Colombian coffee grower for the National Federation of Coffee Growers.
It was a fictional character, correct?
Yes, ma'am. So he was kind of like the Geico Gecko for the Juan Valdez Cafe coffee chain.
Yeah, and he had the sombrero and the poncho
and the mustache. Yeah.
And so looking at Derek, it was the mustache, and I kept thinking hipster modern version of Juan Valdez. Ah. Because in my mind, I have just put Derek like synonymous with coffee. Mm-hmm. Like Derek's branding of the Washtaws, I don't just see his logo and the cool designs and the aesthetic of the place. I see Derek.
Sure.
And so I'm like, Juan Valdez. The second thing that was going through my head was when we were visiting with Derek about the grades of coffee. And so he said that you've got basically, you know, the grade that you'd buy in the grocery store, which is, what did he call that? Not community, but...
Commodity
coffee. And then you've got the higher grades, like, which, you know, you would buy at a coffee shop, basically, like his grades. And he only carries, you know, high grades of coffee, basically. But I kept thinking about this article that I had read somewhere about the... either South American, I think it's South American animal that I almost can't even spit this out, but I guess the animal could. This South American animal that ingests coffee beans and then defecates them out, and then they are harvested and it produces a certain type of coffee which costs a whole lot more money. So I asked producer Trey to look into this and he kind of recalled what I was talking about, but I think he's actually got the real information, so I'm not just guessing at what the animal is, where it was, and what the process is.
We're all adults here. We can say poop. Like, but that's not too far.
So yeah, what's this animal that poops out the coffee beans and then we pay a lot of money to drink the pooped coffee beans?
So it's an Indonesian coffee, and the coffee is called, and I'm probably butchering this because I can't find a pronunciation of it, it's Kopi Luwak or something, and it's a coffee that consists of partially digested coffee cherries. So they eat it and then it's eaten up by their belly and
digested and then it's
pooped out. And the animal that eats it is a civet, so it's called civet coffee as well.
Does it have anything about pricing or, like, you know, buying, or if it's only sold in certain areas?
It's sold worldwide, but the price is $1,300 per kilogram for the wild collected beans.
Per kilogram for the beans.
For wild collected beans.
Not processed at all. Just Wow.
Just randomly found in poop in the wild.
Yeah.
I wonder which of those processing washing methods that Derek told us about they would use on that.
That sounds like a really interesting job.
The civet is not an attractive animal either.
I was going to ask Trey, would you please describe for us what the civet looks like?
Imagine you stepped on a piece of bubble gum.
Okay, I stepped on bubble gum.
Okay, and then imagine you try to scrape that bubble gum off. Okay, mm-hmm. That's what this thing's face looks like.
Oh, that poor civet. I apologize to civet lovers worldwide. All right, well, I think that wraps it up for us today. As always, thank you for listening to the Ouachita Chronicles. You can find us, along with other great shows, at theouachitapodcast.com. You can contact us at theouachitapodcast@gmail.com. Make sure you find us on Facebook and Instagram and give us a like. Make sure you hit subscribe. We always love to hear from fans. If you've got suggestions for future guests on the show or questions about anything that's happened on our previous episodes, or you want to get in touch with one of the guests we've had on, just holler at us at that email. And until then, we'll see you next time. Ashley and Jerry,
out. Thank you for listening to the Ouachita Chronicles.